Last week, we had a discussion on memes. It was interesting that when I left the class, as I was walking out, several people said, we'd like to have some more of that. And I thought, well, there's no shortage of memes, and there are no shortage of themes in those memes. As a matter of fact, yesterday I found an entire website that was devoted to, in some respects, ridiculous articles that are on current topics that I thought, you know, these are memes, because they're very, let me give you the definition again here. It's an image or statement deemed to be of passing value in cultural discourse, usually pithy, biting, cynical, or exaggerated. Well, these weren't very pithy in the sense of being just a couple of words or a sentence. They were entire articles, but they were short articles, a couple of paragraphs. I was talking with Nancy Martin about it, and I showed her one. And because she asked me, she says, well, who determines what's a meme? And I said, well, we do. And she said, well, who's we? And I said, anyone who's reading it or looking at it. So the definition is what we see up here, what we're going to be working from today. So if you read an article that you could hand off to somebody and they could read it in, say, a minute, you could consider that a meme too if it were something that was biting or cynical or pithy or exaggerated. Last time we went through a couple of them, one of them was on prayer. We had a very difficult time with that one. And I was thinking during the week, how could we make this one more easily answered? And yesterday I was at a conference and I was sitting next to Ken Samples, who's the resident philosopher theologian at Reasons to Believe. And I said, Ken, you know, I've been teaching on memes and I plan to continue doing that. And one of them was on prayer. How would you tell somebody who says to you, prayer is somebody acting like they're doing something but really doing nothing? And we talked for a while about that, and he got into some of the things that we got into. But what was interesting is he said, you know, one of the things that Christians don't do a lot of is to make the point that prayer is not only about acquiring something you want, but it's about changing who you are. And that non-Christians don't really recognize that, but that opens up a very interesting conversation. And he said it also opens up interesting conversations to those of us who follow Christ, because so many of us want something, and it will be something virtuous. It's not that we want evil things. It's that we want good things, but they aren't good enough, or they aren't good at the right time. And so what does that do for us? It changes us. Somehow we learn, as we pray, to keep praying and adjust ourselves to the will of the Lord. Lord, I don't know why this isn't happening. What is it that you need me to learn? And what is it that you need me to do? Who else should I be talking to? There are a lot of other considerations there. So we got through this one. There was another one that had to do with prayer confirmation bias, which is that everything you see confirms that prayer works. If not right now, then later on, because after all good things are going to happen to those who believe. Well, confirmation bias also applies to everything else as well. So that was, in some respects, trivial. And that's what I would tell somebody if they told me that. I'd say that your whole claim that prayer is a confirmation bias is just a trivial claim. It doesn't say or prove anything. Then we have the ones that were appeals to pity. For example, the one we see on the screen right now that says, since God can't heal amputees, science will. Well, is that really true? Now, science isn't going to heal amputees, but the real issue here is as if the person who wrote this is second-guessing God, saying, well, God won't do what he could do to heal children. Well, that's true. Okay, so now what? Does that prove that God doesn't exist, or does that just prove God isn't what you want him to be? Then we had the four-panel cartoon where there was a disaster and a journalist was sticking his microphone into the face of a little stick man victim. All of the stick man victim's relatives and friends and everybody else were killed, and this person, the journalist says, aren't you thanking God that that you're okay? And then the person turns around and says, well, if I killed your friends and leveled your village and so forth, would you be thanking me? And so the point there is, why should we thank God for saving anybody if he destroys all these other people? Which is another interesting question. And does this allow us to move into something other than just what they're talking about? Or should it? What do you think? Does this talk about pain and suffering, good and evil, God's sovereignty? Please.
When you see a cartoon like this, I can't help but think about John. I'm sorry, not John, Joseph, and what he went through. Being sold into slavery, being accused of a crime he didn't commit, finding himself in prison, and at the end of that point, I don't know if he was what he was thinking, but how the heck did I end up here? I was only doing my father's will. Yet, the bigger picture is, I think, what we have to see. Tragedies happen. Amputees come along. But what is the bigger picture, which I think affects the rest of society or the circle that those things do occur in? It's maybe more for us to change and to do what we're supposed to do in relation to God's will.
Thank you. One of the things we talked about last week was the question of whether God should intervene. Why should he intervene every time there's people involved? What are the problems with God intervening every time there are people involved? So let's look at this cartoon for a second. You have a tornado goes through, rips up a town or a number of towns. People are killed or houses are destroyed. And then people are shaking their fist at God, saying, God, why did you do this to us? And then the question that the atheist would ask is, why didn't God turn the tornado around and maybe just go out to the grain fields instead of to the houses? Or why did he even have the tornado at all? Why not just turn tornadoes off? We don't really need them anyway. Go ahead. We have somebody in the back.
Well, I remember last week we came up with this idea, like, why do people, you know, live in Tornado Alley, and why do people live where there's hurricanes? And, you know, they don't want to accept any blame at all. They just want to seem to blame it on bad, well, you know, if they don't believe in God, they say they have bad luck or some ridiculous notion like that.
Go ahead, John.
Also, it would be reasonable if you have a house in a fire-prone area that you have a fireproof house, or if you're in an area subject to tornadoes that you have a very exceptional construction to withstand a tornado, or if you live in an area that's subject to flooding that the house is on is above the level of the where the flood could occur, then someone. Florida are being redesigned so that there's a garage in the first floor and then the house is above that. So all these things, they're part of the natural realm. The earth is not as perfectly optimal as it could be because the original human beings decided not to be under the loving guidance of their creator, but to decide for themselves what they would do and what would be right and wrong. And they were told that under that plan of autonomy that there would be problems that would occur. And so the last many thousands of years, the data has accumulated so that people can recognize the nature of living in that autonomous mode so that they will be truly accountable if they're given a choice to enter into divine perfection and yet still want to maintain that mode.
Thank you. One over there.
I would question whether there's really biblical evidence for the notion that natural disasters are retribution for the fall. What we interpret as natural disasters actually have a role in the physics and maintenance of the planet we live on. So, got any scriptures?
Thank you. You know, where you're going there is exactly where we wanted to go, which is this: the atheist or the person who shakes their fist at God and says, "Why are you creating these calamities?" And I listened to one atheist who said, "The Bible even says God creates calamity." And it does. Actually, the Bible does say God creates calamity. It's in a very narrow context, but the truth is it does say that. So let's ask the question, though. What if God didn't do that? So what if you didn't have tornadoes? What if you didn't have hurricanes? What if you didn't have earthquakes or volcanoes or all the things that Hugh Ross has talked to us about in this class for 40 years that are required for the maintenance of humanity? You've got to have these things. Thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate that, John. We have to have these things. So if we have to have these things to stay alive, the second point is, what if, as one atheist said, well, God can just intervene at those points where they're going to conflict with humanity. Everywhere else, he can keep having hurricanes in these places where there's no people. All right. So when you do that, what are the consequences for science? Remember, we did talk about this last week. See if we can call this back up. What are the consequences for science if God intervenes in nature every time there's a conflict with nature and humanity? There's an answer over here. And I thank the runner who's so diligent in taking that microphone all over the place. His ministry is definitely needed. Thank you.
Just to lose weight.
Okay, well, short answer, I think it's just that science depends on universal laws. And if those laws were always being violated, so to speak, by God's intervention, it would undercut the basis of science.
Amen. That's exactly where we were going. Is that science operates on the regularity of or principles of universal laws that we have, universal laws of physics and biology. Now, if we cannot rely on those laws to act like laws because they're constantly changing, then how do you do science? How do you take it? Pardon me?
Chaos.
It's actually what you would end up with, because we wouldn't know in advance where God's going to intervene. And so every time we start making predictions or starting to use what we think are laws of physics, they end up being maybe suggestions of physics, not really laws of physics. Well, maybe this will happen. And so one of the things that we have to hand back to the atheist or the person who's angry at, quote, angry at God for a natural disaster killing people is, if you want God to be accountable, then just ask yourself, how would you deal with a world where God constantly stopped the laws of physics? You would say, well, God could do something else. Well, you're going to keep doing that. Nothing will please you but your own ideas, and you have about 7 billion ideas out there. So which one of them's right? None of them. Only God is right. Go ahead.
Okay, as I look at this cartoon, I see a fool who's complaining he was spared, and he may have been the one who was touched by God and saved by a miracle, but he doesn't even see that. He just sees all the stuff you should blame God for.
Yes.
And he, you know, he's experienced a miracle and he's denying the goodness of God.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. It's as if that you would expect the journalist to say, oh, well, too bad God didn't kill you too, and kind of equalize everything. Yeah, then there wouldn't be any injustice here. Yeah, that would be just as silly. But your point is well taken. Thank you. So let's just go. Oh, did you have a point you wanted to make?
Comment to add a different twist, different perspective. I've read a couple of books on astronauts that have written about long time in space, and they end up making at least me, and I think they are too, I know one of them is,
very grateful for gravity, for air pressure, for so many things. The body goes so far south. We cannot, even if we know a few things, we cannot know all the different things that are fine-tuned and prescribed for us by God. And we also, as well, we can't, that's in the now. Hugh has pointed out how in the past all the different things have been made for us, and we can't see in the future how all things work for good. So that adds a few perspectives.
Yes, thank you. So then we had the next one, which was, God loves you so much that he created hell, just in case you don't love him back. Now that's kind of a biting, pithy statement, isn't it? Is it true? What do you think? Is this true? We have one response down here.
Well, since last week, I listened to Art of Manliness podcast.
Whose?
Art of Manliness.
Okay, Art of Manliness.
And they're talking about human ethics mainly. And an interesting issue came up about hell or bad things in life. For some reason, it's an essential component. And he brought up an interesting statistic that the religions where they admit there, yes, we have a God that has a place of punishment. Those religions can do just as well or better at retaining people as the religions who always skirt the issue, or the denominations that skirt the issue. Discipline is as important a tool with raising kids as incentives, positive incentives, like the stick versus the carrot. And so after listening to something like that, you know, I think I would bring up the human nature is complex. Just because there's some bad things in a particular religion doesn't mean you can discount the entire religion. For some reason, we as a people seem to be designed to deal with bad things.
Thank you. If you were to, oh, good, we have a couple more comments.
Actually, the saying is incorrect. Yes, there is a hell, but it's not because people won't love him back. It's because people don't want to go to heaven, and that's a different reason. To force someone to love God, to follow Jesus, not of their own free will, would be an awful thing. So hell is there not because they don't love God, is they don't want to love God, and they're not being forced to. And I think that's a very actually loving thing.
Thank you. One here, and then I think Ruth had something.
C.S. Lewis wrote a book called The Great Divorce. And in that book, he said hell was locked from the inside. And you have all these people that have an opportunity to get out of hell, but they won't leave. They are so stuck on their argument of why they were justified and why they were right for doing what they did that no matter how many opportunities they had, they wouldn't leave anyway. So that statement does not hold any truth.
Thank you.
When I look at this statement, I'm thinking, God loves you so much that he created heaven, and just in case you reject him, he created hell for you. Wouldn't that make more sense?
It seems like that's a little closer.
Yeah.
This makes it seem like God created hell specifically to tune up the people who wouldn't like him. And that's not the reason why hell was created. So as we get into the theology of this, it's way off. The interesting thing about, or one of the interesting things about this, is that it provokes a question of what is the nature of hell, and what is the nature of choice, and what is the nature of God's sovereignty over our choice, election, predestination, and all of those things. It's a really messy subject. And so what they have done here is to try to make something that's exceedingly complicated into something seemingly simple by aggressing it very aggressively, by attacking it very aggressively in a way that if someone who wrote this were to talk to you, they would probably say, I don't want to hear about all that other stuff. Well, then you're giving exactly the example of why people end up in hell. They don't want to hear about God. So there's one thing to not like God, and there's another thing to be indifferent to him. And indifference is just as bad, maybe even worse, because you don't even think he's worth confronting. Now, did somebody in the back have something?
Yeah, I'll keep it simple. I have a question. Does anybody here think that we're going to have a chance to plead our case? Because you hear atheists say that, you know, like, I have a whole lot of things I want to say to God. Is it even going to be like that, or what do you think?
Well, since the scriptures say before God no man is justified, there isn't much of a case to present. It'd be like going to court and the judge has already declared you guilty. Go ahead and talk, but you're done. You had your opportunity before you got into court. Please.
The bottom line suggests that not loving God is kind of a trivial offense. Jesus had a different take on that when they asked him, what is the greatest commandment? And I think that his answer suggests that that is also the greatest offense, not loving God, and everything else flows from that.
But say that one more time. I don't think I caught what you were saying.
Okay, just in case you don't love him back, the assumption there, the appeal is that, well, this is so trivial, why would God send somebody to hell? But Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your mind, your heart, and soul. Well, if that's the greatest commandment, then not loving him may well be the greatest offense.
Thank you. It is the greatest offense. Yeah, a rejection of God is the greatest offense. But here are some of the things that we need to consider, and we're not going to get through them all today. I guarantee you we're not, because the whole purpose of today was to really get through the memes and let you see how much more there is to these things than they seem. But in the question of loving God, do we even know who God is, and do the people who reject him know who he is? If someone were to present this to me, I'd say, do you know who God is, why you should love him? Do you know why he loves you? Do you know what it means to love a God who loves you so much that he will die for you? There's an entire gospel presentation built into the answer to this, that if we miss it, because this is kind of offensive, then we miss an opportunity to take one of these memes and turn it around into a gospel presentation. Is there another? Go ahead.
I'm actually trying to read it first. Kathleen Lyon says, angels had a perfect environment and unmarred access to a loving relationship with God, with no threat of hell, at least initially, yet many of those choose to rebel against God in the best of circumstances.
Yes. Amen. That God didn't have to design it for us to not love him. The angels were with him all the time, and some of them rejected him already. Thank you. So let me move on to the next one. This is very much like the first one. So it's a picture of, kind of a artificial photograph or picture of what Jesus is often portrayed to be. And it says, what do you mean you're worshiping other gods? I'll have you killed if I can't have you. So this is a variant of the theme that we just went through. I'll have you killed? Not really. Jesus didn't say, I'll have you killed. Jesus said, you'll be accountable for your sins. Yeah, it does sound like this is maybe an attack on Islam. Yeah. Any other points or questions you want to make of this? This was just kind of a variant of what we already talked about. Now, this one's interesting because everyone in this room believes in two things, at least those of us who follow Christ. We believe that God predestines, and we also believe that each one of us has free will. both of those things coexist. Neither you nor I nor anybody on this planet knows how. So what the person who wrote this is saying is, there's only one way. It's only predetermination. So how would you answer this? If someone were to, if you were to see this, or someone were to say to you, well, you're predestined. You're predetermined to do everything you did because God knows in advance everything you're going to do. How would you answer that? Please.
I read a quote from, I think it was A.W. Tozer, who said, in the beginning, God predestined that man would be free to choose. So when he chooses to obey, he's operating in God's will. And when he chooses to disobey, he's operating in God's will.
Very well said. I'd like Tozer to come and talk.
Genius. He is really a genius.
Absolutely.
His pursuit of God is phenomenal.
Yes. Thank you very much. So there is the problem that we have here. Is it's another problem of oversimplification and exaggeration of one side of the question rather than taking into account both sides. Please, go ahead, Ruth.
If you look at the face, how dare you? That's already assuming that God is only an angry God, an evil, angry God. They don't know God's characteristics if they're going to put something like that up. That's just one facet of God's characteristics, the God of justice. But this one is just all angry, and this is some other God, but it's definitely not the God of love.
Yes, thank you. That is the case, and that's probably why this is an utterance of absurdity. So in other words, what the author is saying is, it's absurd that God is telling you or predetermining you to do something and then punishing you for doing it. So he must be an angry, weird God that he allows you to, that you can't do anything but what he predetermined to do, and by the way, he's angry at you for doing it.
God gets angry, though.
Of course God gets angry. Did you have a point you wanted to make in the back? Mike, could you get the microphone out there?
Yep. I just wanted to add, probably sounds like the first point that was brought up, what's predetermined and what's not, it's like the butterfly effect. Everything in that system, it's set. But even a slight change, it will come out to a different result. So that's predetermined.
Yes, thank you. But we do not know how it is that God is sovereign, controls everything, and yet gives us free will. But we are accountable for our free will. And ask anybody, including the wildest naturalist, materialist, who says that our brains predetermine us. Ask them, do you not have free will? Now, some of them will tell you free will is an illusion. And I will say, how do you know that? Well, they can't answer that, except to say that, well, it's obviously, because chemistry is already predetermined, it's going to do what it's going to do, then you can't do anything about it. And then the answer to that is, well, that's pretty stupid because we're having a conversation, and I know chemistry didn't make this conversation. You and I did. And we can quit anytime we want. So there's a certain degree to which there is some bounded predetermination in nature, but what this particular meme does is it mischaracterizes the nature of our relationship with God as being only predetermination and devoid of free will, and that God is therefore absurd for forcing us to do something, predetermining it, and then holding us accountable for doing the wrong thing, as if he guided us to do evil, when the Bible explicitly says God does not guide people to do evil. He is not the author of evil. Which again, one of the wonderful things about these memes is it allows us to turn this into a gospel presentation. We just have to pry into it to find it.
We got a question from online. It says, I would ask, quote, are jails good, unquote? Let them answer. Answer is yes. Jails are good to put away criminals. Hell is for those who have committed crimes against their creator.
Thank you.
You're
looking at as hell as kind of a punitive sentence like a jail. Well, that's not far off. I think there is a certain way in which that's true. Yeah. And it also, that course corresponds to what is the nature of hell? Is it entirely punitive? Is it punitive and detaching? In other words, keeping people from being in heaven? You know, to detach us from heaven is one thing. To punish people and detach them is another thing. So it opens up a lot. And that answer was very, very interesting. Thank you. So now let's get into some other kinds of memes here. So this one, that's a caricature of a... What movie was this guy in? Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Okay, thank you. And he says, the religion your parents taught you as a child is the one true religion. Well, what a coincidence. Now, this is an interesting play on some statistics. Because statistically, people will adopt the religion of their family. So if you're in a particular place in Asia where they adopt Buddhism, you're more likely to be a Buddhist than you are to be a Christian. If you grow up in a Christian zone, you're more likely to be a Christian than you would be to be a Buddhist or anything else. And so there is some truth to the fact that people will adopt the religious views of their parents. But where is the fallacy in this?
I was brought up as an atheist. So I'd love to point that out to these people that think that there's just like a steadfast rule. But I guess statistics back this up kind of. There's a cultural influence. That's one thing I think is true about Christianity, though, is it's kind of cross-cultural. Certainly it is now. You can maybe make an argument when it first started it was a kind of a Jewish thing. But then Paul went through that whole thing, you know, bringing the Gentiles in. So I don't think that argument holds water for Christianity. It probably holds water for other religions, you know, but... of course, we don't say Christianity is a religion, right? It's a way of life, and it's a relationship, and all that. Yeah, but
thank you. Well, from the point of what this person is saying here, the religion your parents taught you as a child is the one true religion. What a coincidence! So this is a claim not just against Christians; it's against anybody who holds a religious belief. Now the question is, does the claim that you were raised in a particular religious belief justify the claim that it's true? Boom. Now we're into a gospel presentation.
Well, it says, as a child. A child, when they're given a set of beliefs, especially from the parents, from their minds, it is true. Because the parents said it as a child. When you grow up as an adult, then you start reasoning and using logic, and, you know, God's hand is going to be on that child from the day they're born. But from a child's perspective, it is true until you become an adult and then start looking around and saying, is this really true? You start thinking about what I believe. Is this really true? Let's look at and compare it to all the other ones. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. And I think that's where we should really go with this, and that is, if you grew up in a particular culture or your parents had a particular religion and that's what they raised you with and told you this is the one true religion, and this is going on all over the world. There's different religions all over the place and children are raised to be in that religion. Now the question is that the only reason why, for example, Christianity claims to be true? There are other religions that don't claim to be exclusively true. There are others that definitely do. So we'll see somebody's claim or comments on that later. There's another meme that talks explicitly about that. But getting to the point here, if because you were raised in a particular religion, you happen to believe it's true, doesn't make it to be true. So I would say if someone says, well, you know, there's evidence that people will adopt the religions of their childhood. I would say, so what are you saying? That they're all false because they were raised that way? Were you raised to be a follower of science? Is 2 and 2 not 4 because your parents told you that? Oh, what a coincidence. That's one true mathematics. Doesn't work that way. The question is what you're saying true for itself, not for how you were raised? And that's where the gospel presentation comes in. If someone says, well, you only believe in Christianity because that's the way your parents trained you, Well, I'd say, first of all, my parents didn't train me to be a Christian. I was like the gentleman in the back. I was raised to be an atheist. Didn't work out so well for the atheists. So, but let's say I did. Let's say I was raised as a Christian, and I were to say, well, it is the true religion. And you were to say, well, that's only because your parents taught you that. I'd say, how do you know that? How do you know it's not true? Well, everybody in the world says their own religion is true. I said, no, that's not the question. The question is, how do you know what I'm telling you about Jesus Christ is not true? We've got to get to that, and we have to make that move, because that's where the gospel lies. The gospel lies right squarely in the claim that Jesus Christ died, rose from the dead, and saved us from our sins. That is the truth of the gospel. Now, let's argue about whether that's true. Not who raised me and what religion I was raised in. Somebody in the back?
Just a comment on people don't come to believe in Santa Claus as an adult, yet as a child, everybody thought believed in Santa Claus, but later on gave it up because there was no factual evidence. And since nobody does come to believe in Santa Claus as an adult, it's not based on like something of like evidence.
Yes, thank you. So let me, oh, you got one more? Okay.
Pears. One more you said, right? Everything.
What did you say? Okay.
We forget one thing that has not been mentioned, and that is, if you use mathematics, you got the book. Any science, you have the book. Any law, there's the book. Jesus used the book to the devil. Says it's written three times. Now the Bible teaches, because one man blew it, we're all in that category. We're all sinners. And the people will say, well, that's unfair. I mean, I had nothing to do. Well, there's something very easy for you to do. God already placed your name in here. If you want to, you can accept him. And that will solve the problem. By one man, a sin came, by other man, grace came by. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But everything we have is in the Bible. And the Bible also teaches that God said, I can do anything I want to, for glory or for bad. He's in charge, okay? So if he does something, that means he knows. I don't. So how can we question God? We just have to follow just like Job did, just like Abraham did. Just trust him. And so that's why the gospel has come, to take you out of that place, that misery that you're going to be destined to if you don't accept this. So that's what I'm saying. Everything I have is based on the Bible, okay?
Okay, we believe you. All right, so here's another one. This one's a little bit more rational. It's kind of surprisingly rational, actually. And it has a list. It says reasons to believe in God, and then has a whole bunch of them stricken out. So the one that it says is acceptable is blind faith as a reason to believe in God. But the ones that are stricken out, proof of events, historical evidence, credible testimony, logical reasoning, rational conclusion, deductive reasoning, and plausibility, those are all stricken out. So what's the claim here? Well, the claim is that none of these things, there is no proof of events or historical evidence or credible testimony or logical reasoning, etc., that the only thing that we have to believe in God is a blind faith. Now, I say this is rational because it's so easy to defeat rationally. Go ahead, John.
It just so happens that there's an organization called Reasons to Believe.
What a coincidence.
Check it out, yeah.
Thank you. We have another one over here, Ruth.
The person who wrote this doesn't have real Christians who know how to defend Christianity. The fact that they think this is it, that's only the ones with blind faith, I believe, means that's what he sees or she sees. And in the media, they always have weak pastors and people who represent God in such a foolish way. They don't know anything, how to reason or anything. They just talk like they have blind faith. Oh, just trust. That's all you need. And period. And then people like Dr. James Dobson, who goes on TV, and he tries to start talking, and then they hush him down, and then have the other crazy evangelist start talking, and then he turns around thinking, why am I being hushed? Because they know that he really knows how to talk or reason. I know from personal experience that he just was so upset that they just shut him down so quickly. And every time you see on TV, in the media, it's the same story. It's the blind faith type of evangelist that makes Christians look so bad, and that just angers me. So I wish there was more people, reasons to believe, to be in the media or out there to say, hey, there are people who know how to defend Christianity in proof of events and historical evidence to all of the other ones.
Yes. Yeah, there's Southern California is uniquely situated. I think it's the center of the galaxy of apologetics. I mean, the headquarters of apologetics, they're all over the place, but they're in Southern California. I don't know why. Maybe we're just smarter than everybody else. I don't know what to say, you know, but here we are. Yeah, right. But there are, the point is that there are proofs of events, but I don't really like that word, proof. But there are evidences of the events, the evidence of the resurrection, evidence of Christ's existence. I mean, Christ's existence is not, his historicity isn't even in dispute anymore among the very, very pinnacle of historians, not Christian historians, historians in general who look at that period of time. No one's arguing this guy Jesus didn't exist. So we have some evidence to start our faith in that's historical, that doesn't even have to require you to be a Christian to believe it.
Back in the late 80s, early 90s, the Jesus Seminar came into existence, and the purpose of that was to disprove Christianity. And what they did was unleash a whole bunch of new scholars that blew their arguments to hell, and it was like William Craig, Craig Evans, and many others. It is based on evidence. The one thing Christianity doesn't subscribe to is blind faith.
It's exactly the opposite, isn't it?
Yeah, because my Christian faith is based upon the resurrection of Christ. If he didn't come out of that tomb, you can keep Christianity.
That's right. Even Jesus said, if you don't believe what I'm saying, look what I'm doing. He was evidentiary. And when Thomas came in, what was Thomas saying? I'm not going to believe until I see what? Until I see the wounds. What did Jesus do? Showed him the wounds. Said, here it is. Here's the empirical evidence. Do you need more? I've healed people. I've raised the dead. I'm kind of running out of things to do, guys. What do you want me to do? The bottom line is that we do have reasons to believe in God that are based in historical evidence. So why they would line this out, I'm not quite sure, except that exactly what Ruth mentioned is that so many followers of Christ are completely inept at even talking about this. Not being experts. We all cannot be experts. Matter of fact, most of us will never be experts, and that's fine. Jesus never called us to be experts in apologetics. But we should at least know that when somebody asks us, how do you know Jesus ever existed? We can say, well, we know there's historical evidence. And they say, well, where is it? I don't know yet. I'll help you find it. Work with me on this. Start a relationship with somebody who does know this and lead them to either a resource or to a person who can help them understand it. But if you do what so many Christians do, which is to merely say, well, I just believe it and I'm, you know, just go away and leave me alone, then you haven't given an answer for the faith that's within you. You've actually violated Scripture when you do that. Yesterday I was talking to a gentleman at a conference, and he was a pastor who deals with youth. So his whole ministry is on young people. And I asked him, what is the number one question that young people ask you in, when you're doing these things? Because one of the things he was doing was bringing apologetics into youth ministry. And I said, I think you need to really do that a lot. He said, oh, yeah, we do, because we're losing a lot of young people. And I said, so what is, when you do your apologetic conferences for youth, what is the number one question they ask you? And he says, you know, there isn't any number one question they ask. What there is the number one complaint that they have. And their number one complaint that they have is that people in their church, particularly the pastors and the people in charge, will not answer their questions. And so very often, they will have a problem with a pastor or a youth pastor or somebody they trust in the church. And what happens in their mind is, well, this person represents Christianity. If they can't answer the question, no one can answer the question. Therefore, my faith is in vain. What a terrible thought. And what a fantastic reason for us to learn. So that when young people do ask us questions, we can at least tell them, I don't know the answer to that very particular question, but I know it's answerable. Let's work together to do that. And that was basically what he was doing, because he was not an expert in all of these apologetic things. We happened to be in an apologetic conference where there was just filled with apologetic experts. Hugh Ross and all of the RTB crew and William Lane Craig and a whole bunch of other people. And so the question was, how do we get the information from people like these brilliant men and women who are in that room, to the youth people, to recognize that there's just enormous amounts of philosophical and scientific evidence to support the faith?
And that problem suggests that churches are going about youth ministry in the wrong way. Youth ministers need to be not necessarily experts in apologetics, but they need to know that there are experts out there that can be referenced. So in addition to providing, you know, a closeness in age and credibility from a social perspective, they need to have a little bit more knowledge about apologetics.
I think so, and that was a point that he made as well, is that a youth pastor has to know a lot more in our culture than he did 50 years ago. Because 50 years ago, or even less than that, but at least 50 years ago, many people at least understood who Jesus was. And they could make a decision one way or the other with some degree of understanding. And so the youth pastor would be talking to people who were at least understanding that. But in the past 50 years, it's been a different world. Science has taken over, and the people who believe in science as scientism, that it answers all the questions, have spoken over the people who believe that science and Christianity both correspond. And so now it's either or in the minds of many, and if you don't show them that it's both, you'll lose them. And if you don't show them that their questions can be answered and are answerable, and some of the answers are difficult, and that's one of the things that scares people away. When I've watched some, in just informal conversations, I've watched some Christians try to answer questions, and I realize they're intimidated by it, and they don't know that they should answer the question. And so they try and answer a question that they know instead, and they just dodge the question. And it disappoints me. It shocks me as well that they don't recognize you can't just blind faith your way through this. We need to have reasons to believe. Okay, so we have this meme that alleges indirectly that there really aren't any proof of events. We just have evidence of events. We do have historical evidence. Is there credible testimony? Well, there's credible testimony of people alive today, too, of events that they saw and witnessed and participated in and experienced. Logical reasoning. Is Christianity based in logical reasoning? And if we just capture the next one, rational conclusions. You can't have rational conclusions without logical reasoning. Is Christianity based in logical reasoning? It's okay to say yes.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. I'm glad you agreed. It is. It's not exclusively logical in the sense that we're just coming up with arguments and coming up with premises and trying to prove them to be valid or strong. There are things that you experience that aren't propositional arguments. But every argument that Christianity poses is logical. It's logically valid. It's logically sound, because the claims are true and the conclusions based on them are also true. And they have to be. Do we use deductive reasoning? Well, we're getting kind of into some technical stuff here. Yes, we use deductive reasoning. We use inductive reasoning. We use abductive reasoning. We use all sorts of reasoning. And last, plausibility. That's the easiest one. Is our faith plausible? Go ahead, Ruth.
But the logical reasoning, if you just kept it simple and say, you know, if you believe in Jesus, you'll have eternal life in heaven. If not, it's the opposite. You're going to go to hell. That's your choice. He gave you a choice. And logically, let's see, do I want to go to hell and suffer? Or do I want to go to heaven and enjoy the glory of God and, you know, all the things you can tell him about heaven from the Revelation? Well, logically, yes. And then I say, well, you can't lose, you know, if you just choose heaven. Why wouldn't you? You know, just in case, if Jesus came back, wouldn't you want to say, yeah, I believe, just so you can go to heaven? I mean, it just logically, you want the safe route, not the dangerous route.
Yes, and basically any decision you make that's not aesthetic is going to have to have a logical basis for it. So an aesthetic judgment would be something like, I'm not reasoning my way to believing that I like vanilla. Okay, I just like vanilla. I don't need logic to get me there. I don't have to. There's no argumentation that's going to make me like Bach. You know, I love to listen to Bach. There's no logic to that. So that's an aesthetic judgment. I don't have to logic or reason my way through those aesthetic judgments. But these other propositional judgments, they're based in logic. But we don't have to worry about that here right now.
Well, all the fine-tuning points that we're finding in science, the further we explore, the smaller details we can see and the bigger details we can see in the distance, all are logic. I mean, all the fine-tuning of Earth and our planets and solar system and asteroids and everything that produces this one planet we live on that's so ideal for us has logical reasoning that nothing else can answer that. So all the RTB teaching, all the books that Hugh Ross has written are all based on logical reasoning. So, just based on that, there's a lot of evidence, and if you read those books, it gives you a lot of testimony.
Yes, thank you. So anytime you're making a conclusion from evidence, you're going to have to reason your way through it, and it's not blind faith that does that. Now, this is a really long one, and this is a different character of meme, and I wanted to introduce this character of meme because it produces a different kind of discussion. So I'm going to read this long one to you. It's probably very difficult for you to see on the screen. It says, and it's a quote from Kaffa Pollitt, who is a writer. She said, "When you consider that God could have commanded anything he wanted, anything, the Ten Commandments have got to rank as one of the great missed moral opportunities of all time. How different history would have been had he clearly and unmistakably forbidden war, tyranny, taking over other people's countries, slavery, exploitation of workers, cruelty to children, wife beating, stoning, treating women or anyone as chattel or inferior beings." So this is the first time I've ever seen anybody complain that there weren't enough commandments. Now the question is, she says this was one of God's great missed opportunities. I find that interesting that she has placed herself in God's position, but that's kind of the position of humans anyway. We'll do that often. So let's kind of look at some of the things that she talked about there. So did God ever clearly and unmistakably forbid, let's just take one for example, treating women or anyone as chattel? Yes, he did forbid it, as a matter of fact. He did forbid that. Did he forbid war? He forbade war in the sense of taking over a people without God's permission. And that's an important point. He never allowed Israel, and matter of fact, got mad at Saul for doing this, never allowed Israel or anybody else through commandments to go into and raid another place without him commanding it for a very particular reason. So he did forbid war. He did said, don't commit murder. So I don't know how war isn't murder, in the sense that if you do it because you're just doing it for selfish aims and you want to kill people like the Amalekites did, the Amalekites were just nasty little people, and they created wars just because they like killing people and torturing them. They had no other reason. They plundered them and then they tortured them. So God did forbid war, except in very particular situations. He forbade tyranny. Well, tyranny was the oppression of the people by bad leaders. What was God constantly complaining about? Bad leaders. You guys are oppressing your people. The orphans. Who else? The widows. The sojourners. You are oppressing them. He's saying you're constantly oppressing these people. Knock it off. He did forbid that. And he punished them for not taking care of the widows, the orphans, the sojourners, and others. Taking people's property from them for no good reason. Tyranny. He absolutely forbade tyranny. Slavery, he did. There's actually a prohibition against slavery in the Old Testament. Exploitation of workers. Did God say you can't exploit your workers? Yeah, explicitly so. Yes. Please, go ahead.
Well, first of all, she's never read the New Testament.
I don't think she's read the Old Testament.
I don't think so either. But not coveting your neighbor's home, that would forbid war. So that addresses that. And then in the New Testament, where he says, okay, love your Lord, first of all, and then love your neighbor as yourself, that covers all those other things.
It absolutely covers everything else. Yeah. Yes.
So he did cover it. She just is ignorant.
She wanted very specific things, but as it turns out, she was wrong. There actually are explicit prohibitions against the things he was talking about here. And so one of the things that I wanted to bring up is, sometimes the people who make these critiques haven't actually read what they're critiquing. Sir, did you want to make a comment? Let's get a mic over on the back, please. And I find, interestingly, writers and actors do this really promiscuously. They just blab out all sorts of stuff like they know what they're talking about and they haven't got a clue. Yes, sir.
The overreaching thing that comes to me to that is that we firmly know that God has given us complete freedom to make our own choices while being in control at the same time.
Yes.
It's that freedom of choices that she's ignoring here, that is one of God's fundamental things that he has presented to us, and yet he's going to work out things for good eventually.
Thank you. Now here's one that talks about our motivations. It says, believers do good things out of fear of death and hell with expectation of great reward. Atheists do the right thing because it's the human thing to do. Now, this argument presents itself in different forms among atheists. And how do I know that? Because I've been spending a lot of time for the past few months listening to atheists describe their positions. And I mean sophisticated atheists. Some of the unsophisticated atheists are every bit as bad atheists as some of our unsophisticated Christians are bad Christians. You know, they're the equivalent of saying they believe in atheism on blind faith. So, is it true that believers do things out of fear of death and hell?
So
we have a couple of answers over here. We have, go ahead.
I think I have an answer. I think some people are motivated that way, but I don't think that's consistent with Christ's teachings to just do things for reward. We're not even supposed to know what our right hand is doing. You know, separate our right hand from our left hand. And so, yeah.
You need to put your hand next to the mic.
Can you hear me?
I can now.
Testing. Yeah, I don't think that we're supposed to do that. And I think there's plenty of atheists that do the right things to be noticed, not just because it's the right thing to do. So that whole thing breaks down, I think.
Thank you. And I think Warren had one.
I think most people, if you ask them what their motivation is, or if you somehow investigate their motivation, you'll find they do good things out of the joy of their heart and not out of any fear.
Thank you. And I think you're on to something there, Warren, and that is, if you look at the people in this class who put money in the bucket over there to pay for the treats, and the beautiful ladies who always set this up every week, are they doing it because they're afraid of hell? I don't think so. I'll ask you, are you worried about hell, or is that the problem over there? Are you giving us this good food to dodge hell? I don't think so. I think it's because they love you, they love me, they love us, they love the people who come into this class. Every good thing that the people in this class do, they do because they love Jesus, and they love the people who love Jesus. And they love the people who don't love Jesus. And they're not worried about hell. They're worried about what? People. They just want to make sure that people are well taken care of. Ruth.
Well, as a believer, I do good things because I love Jesus so much, and I want to share that love he gave to me to others. And the fear of death is not even existing because Jesus died on the cross, so I don't have fear of death and hell. So when I believe, all that fear is gone. And there's nothing wrong with expecting great rewards in heaven. That's my hope. I have great rewards because out of my love and excitement for Jesus and being in heaven, everyone has expectations. There's nothing wrong with that. And atheists do the right thing. Well, where did they get the definition of right? Where did that set of morals come from? You ask them, where did you get that from? Where did it all start from? And then you go back to the Word of God.
Thank you. You got a couple more?
I think this atheist do the right thing because it's the human thing to do is wishful thinking. Because the last century showed that atheists really don't do the right thing. When you look at everything that communism has done and the atheism that was replete with that. So that's an oxymoron, that the atheists actually do the right thing. Unless death is the right thing for a lot of human beings, you know. So, and yes, of course. I mean, why do we do a lot of things? There's going to be a reward, whether it's the reward of peace in our own lives, whether it's the reward in the afterlife. That's a lot more of a motivator than the human thing to do.
Thank you.
I think the first part of that is rather complex, because unless you're a true born-again believer, we take the position that you're talking about. But there are a lot of people in Christendom who still believe in works. And perhaps they do the things that they do out of fear and death and hell. Okay? Am I really going to heaven? And that's a tragedy of perhaps those who do go to church but don't quite get the saving grace of what Jesus has done. And Phil is right in regards to atheists. In the 20th century, they're responsible for more deaths than anything has ever happened before in the history of mankind.
Genocides and other things, yes. It's important to realize, remember, it's not atheism that did it, it's atheists who did it. So some people will say, and it sounds like I'm parsing my words here too closely, but the truth is that atheism isn't a drive to do evil. It's a claim that they either A, believe that God does not exist, or B, they don't know, they don't have to see the evidence for it. So we have to be at least charitable and understanding to their position to recognize that A, not all atheists are the same, and B, that whatever kind version of atheism it is individuals, not the belief system, that causes the mass, you know, the genocides and the purges and the Stalinesque activities, etc. We know, for example, in Russia, when Stalin was in power, he did everything he could to suppress religion. So that was an overt hatred of religion and belief that it's contrary to the position of the state. Karl Marx, same thing, although he had some ideas about religion that were, maybe it could be used instrumentally, but not for anything other than to pursue his political agenda. So my point is this, that we have to be careful when we when we talk about atheists, that some atheists will do bad things, some atheists won't do bad things. And atheism is not a driver of evil. It is not a driver of evil. Now, in one sense, you could say, well, it is, because if you're an atheist, then you're rejecting God. In that sense, I'll agree with you. But it is not a driver of moral evil. It's not like Satanism, which says, go out and do evil, or some other isms that actually cause people to do evil. All right, so there's somebody else here.
And so I like that thread where it's too easy just to exaggerate and say, oh, all those atheists, they're doing the wrong things. But this is... this meme is turning around and looking at historic Christianity, where fear of death, hell, of course those things are going to be used, like with your children. Be careful, because you could die if you run out into the middle of the road. Fear, there's nothing wrong with using fear of death in instruction. Sometimes it's totally appropriate. So they're kind of putting fear of death and hell in like this kind of, you know, pedagogical, immature category, so that believers look immature and historic Christianity looks immature.
Thank you. And last time I checked, the atheists that I know were still afraid of being dead. Yeah, so they here it says atheists do the right thing because it's the human thing to do. And Ruth brought up the question, well, where did you get these morals? Did you borrow them from somebody? Who would that somebody be? Now, I was listening to a couple of very, very sophisticated atheists a few days ago, and they said, well, we are atheists in the sense that we do not find the evidence for the existence of God sufficient. So we're not saying there isn't a God. We're just saying we don't find the evidence for him sufficient. Now, you may be able to give us more evidence, and we might change our mind. We don't think so, but maybe we will. But we believe you can have a morality without a God. And the proof of that is that look at all the things that we do that are already moral. Now, the person who was on the other side of the argument didn't challenge the question, what's morality? Because where do you even get the notion of a morality? And the person didn't answer that question, but he did say, we don't have to have a God to have morality because we can see it ourselves. And they actually use the term, it's the human thing to do. Now, it's easy on the outside of a debate when I'm, you know, comfortably listening to it on my radio or my cell phone or whatever, to say, well, I would have asked this question, I would have asked that question. Because when you're in the debate, you don't think as quickly and as effectively as you do when you're outside as a spectator. But one of the things I thought of is, I would ask, what makes anything moral? What makes something moral? Is it because it does something that you think is good? Is that moral? So your version of moral and your version of moral and your version of moral are all different. Which one's right? And which one of them's human and which one of them's not human? That there would be no good answer to that. What they will do is they'll come up with some really, really clean, sophisticated ways of dodging the question. And that's what we have to be careful of, is that when somebody says, well, it's just a human thing to do. No, it's not. And by the way, tell me what you mean by the human thing. What makes it a human thing instead of a divine thing? So we have a few minutes left. I'm going to dive into one more. So here's a quote from Richard Dawkins. It says, I'm against religion because it teaches us to be satisfied with not understanding the world. Say again?
Ignorant.
That's very ignorant. Is it true that religion teaches us to be satisfied with not understanding the world?
No.
No, we come to this class because we want to understand the world. And it is our faith in Christ and our love for God that makes us want to know more about it. So Richard Dawkins, there's memes from Richard Dawkins that go on all the time. And if you keep listening to them or watching them, they're pretty easy to defeat because he's part of a group that likes to campaign on emotion, not on reality. Go ahead.
However, I think there is kind of a strain within the church that is kind of against higher learning or higher thinking and doing research and that kind of stuff. I mean, I think our Sunday school class is a little exceptional as far as trying to figure a lot of this stuff out. I don't see this happening in a lot of churches.
Okay, I won't dispute that. My only claim is that Richard Dawkins is wrong, is that religion, that he's against religion because it teaches us to be satisfied with not understanding the world. I think all religions want us to understand the world, even the wrong religions, the ones that get it wrong. They just want to understand it in the wrong way, and in a way that's more comfortable for them. So now this is a picture of a cat reading a book, and the caption says, "The atheist cat says, 'Where's your dog now?'" Now, the atheist cat is reading a book that's written by Richard Dawkins, and it's called The Dog Delusion. And it's a joke on his God Delusion book. And I could not help putting this in there because it was too funny. And it's a kind of a spoof on the God Delusion. And the cat's spoofing it, saying, "Well, where's your dog? There's no dog. I read it in Richard Dawkins' book. There can't be a dog if Richard Dawkins says it's a dog delusion." Sorry, I couldn't help myself. This one was just too funny to pass up. Plus, I know there's some cat lovers in the audience. You would appreciate that the cat's part of the conspiracy. So here we have what we just talked about. You don't need religion to have morals. If you can't determine right from wrong, then you lack empathy, not religion. Well, in some cases, that's true. In some cases, people don't know right from wrong because they lack empathy, because the right thing to do is to do what's right because you love your neighbor, as Jesus said to love him. Now, the big question here is attacking religion attacking us? Yes? No? Maybe? Go ahead. We got a question? Okay. Let me close this up then. When they attack religion, they are attacking us. But we need to distinguish ourselves as not a religion, but as a group of people who are following the real God. And we do that by presenting the gospel and being capable of answering the questions that are posed to us or helping the person find the answers to those questions when we don't know them. So with that, I think we're out of time. And I thank you all very much for being here. Bless you, and have a great weekend.